Hello, Kim here. Quick note before the episode starts. I have been wanting to connect more with you all, and I think I've come up with a couple of options. The first one is, if you've ever thought, gosh, I wish you would talk about this, or I want to hear about this topic, there is now a topic submission form where you can share ideas or questions or links, and that link is in the show notes, so it'll help shape future episodes and also off-the-cuff videos I'm going to be doing on my Patreon for members only. And also on Patreon, the other thing I was hoping to do is to host some informal SLP support spaces, just like low-pressure spaces to decompress and be around people who kind of get it, you know? And if there's enough interest, I also want to include some education around burnout and secondary trauma and things like that. So if that sounds helpful, check the links in the show notes, send me some messages, let me know what you're interested in, and thanks for listening.
Hello there, and welcome to the Trauma-Informed SLP! This is a podcast where we seek... I don't remember my tagline anymore. That's an issue. Hold on. I found my tagline. I found it. This is a podcast where we learn how to promote safety and empowerment and build resiliency in everyone we know, including ourselves. Ha-ha! Pew, 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 pew. I do that pew, pew, pew thing with my dog a lot. I don't know. It's become like my expression of excitement these days. So there you go. This is not the burnout episode. You might have noticed. Psych! In my little mini announcement, I said I'm going to do a burnout. I am still going to do burnout. But I just thought I want to do, hopefully not too long of an episode, on something that I initially presented at my ASHA 2023 talk in Boston. I've put up a bit of a slide, like a reel on Instagram about this, and I did put up a video on my YouTube channel about this, but I feel like on the YouTube one, I sort of kind of babbled a little while before I actually got to the meat of the whole issue. So I'm going to try to record this for the podcast just to like hopefully get to the meat a little faster for folks. Cause you know, my brain does like to do the wandering thing a bit, but, and that is this. In the world, particularly when we talk about autistics, but in with neurodivergence in general, and especially in social media discourse, you see a lot of debate on like, oh, well, does that approach, you know, neurodivergent affirming approaches? Well, is that something that works with profound autistics or severe autistics or people with significant support needs, right? There's always that, okay, that's great that that applies to you, you know, adult, late diagnosed adult autistic, but does that apply to my non-speaking child, right? And I'm using preferred terminology here, but that's not always what you hear online. You hear people say nonverbal and you hear functioning labels still, unfortunately. But I think the issue is, especially within the neurodivergent movement, it becomes difficult to talk about the movement, which is a social justice movement, okay, and how it applies to all the different types of neurodivergence out there, the broad spectrum of neurodivergence. And that's a very different discussion, right? It's hard to talk about that when you're talking about a very diverse spectrum of people. And then when people want to know, how does that apply to this individual that I either work with or my child or my niece or nephew, right? When we're talking individuals, we have one way to talk about things. But when we're talking about a social movement toward more equity and more access to resources and acceptance of these differences and not, you know, and presuming competence and all this stuff, when we want to talk more about that stuff and ableism and how ableism impacts all the different neurodivergence out there, these like social adversities that are faced from neurodivergence as a marginalized group, it gets very difficult to figure out how to talk about the different experiences and how they land under a model of social adversity, right? So I want to talk about the kind of labels we use, the kind of groupings we use, essentially, when we talk about social adversity, societal stuff, the discrimination, the ableism, all of that. I think we just need to be able to use different labels that reframes what's going on in terms of the types of adversities faced, because there are differences in the types of adversity faced for, like, say, a non-speaking autistic or someone in a wheelchair, for example, versus a late diagnosed autistic who people don't even really presume they have it. Or maybe a lot of people online will be like, you're not really autistic, or you're not really autistic enough, right? Like, ugh, what a terrible rhetoric that is. It's very invalidating. Let's not, it's not the best to go that way. But nonetheless, I can see where people are coming from, right? Because you look at significant support needs individuals and you think this person looks so different and their needs are so different that how would what this late diagnosed autistic, what they're advocating for and what they're saying is their experience, how would that relate to the significant support needs, right? And how it relates most of the times is in how we're framing the social adversity that's faced, in my opinion. That's the bigger thing. We're trying to use labels that describe an individual's abilities and or support needs and their strengths and weaknesses. We're trying to use those labels to talk about broader systemic issues with access and equity and things like that, right? So what we need to do, this is just my two cents here, but I think as neurodivergence, as someone within the movement myself, we have to come up with a way to talk about groups of people that's framed in the types of adversity faced systemically versus an individual's abilities. Does that make sense? So hopefully the word is out on this, but high functioning, low functioning, those are not preferred terms in the autistic community, and they're not preferred terms in neurodivergent community in general, really. If you think about it, if somebody turns to you and says, well, you're just not high functioning enough to be included in this thing, it doesn't feel very good, right? It feels very like, what do you mean? What do you mean I'm not good enough, basically, right? It's a very dehumanizing thing to look at a human and say, you're just not functioning at the level we want from a human. It's very dehumanizing in that sense, okay? So not great. The other issue I've had with that, and I think other SLPs have noticed this before, that when people talk about low functioning autistics, especially online, whenever you heard like staff members or even parents talk about it, they almost always were talking about non-speakers, almost always, right? And we as speech language pathologists know that just because someone is non-speaking, it does not mean they are non-thinking, right? It doesn't mean, it's not an indication of their cognitive ability, right? Their ability to communicate with their mouth is not an indication of their brain's function and cognitive ability and intellect, right? But it's a very prevalent bias people have. People have that spread effect, which is from that stigma of disabilities where they see one thing about a person and they presume other things about their abilities in the world, right? Spread effect is where you get like, if somebody sees someone in a wheelchair and they start talking really slow to them, assuming they have a cognitive impairment, or if someone has a visual impairment, people start to talk slower or louder to them as if they have a hearing impairment. That's a spread effect thing where they presume something about their ability based off of one particular issue they have, right? So instead of functioning labels, a lot of people say, let's talk about support needs then, high support needs or low support needs. And I don't know about the rest of you, but professionally, what I noticed at the schools, particularly once these became more accepted terms, it was just a lateral move. People talk about high support needs to mean non-speakers, 9 times out of 10, right? And the low support needs are the speakers, the ones who can speak with their mouth. 9 times out of 10, that was the main distinction I saw with these people. It wasn't anything about their cognitive abilities, but yes, cognitive tests definitely are very biased against non-speakers. We don't really have good tests for that. So they often get lumped in with having like intellectual disability, even if they don't, just because we can't really test their cognitive abilities because those tests are so dependent, so highly dependent on speaking and having access to highly specific, effective language modalities, right? Which younger non-speaking kids don't always have, of course, which is, you know, hey, that's part of our thing, right? AAC for everybody, presumed competence, exact, all that stuff, right? So I think it's kind of a lateral move because once again, people are trying to use support needs about individuals to talk about groups of people and the types of things they face, the types of issues they have with the system. So we're kind of back to that same problem, that same, the spread effect for non-speakers, the stigma, all of that. We're back to all of that, right? And, you know, there's also that issue with just people outside of the neurodivergency movement are still kind of stuck in that very pathological way of thinking of like a disabled person means they're less than, and autistic means like severe and like really obvious, right? Obvious impairments, right? And that's just not, it's not a very useful way, especially when you're thinking, it's not a very useful framework for thinking of a social movement seeking to attain more equity and access to resources, right? So I was thinking about this literally for over a year, and this is what I've come up with in terms of new categories when we're talking about societal systemic stuff, right? So this is relating to my podcast episode on like systemic adversity versus individual adversity and how we do need to kind of parse those things out in terms of what level are we talking about here, right? So I think we need these new categories based off of societal adversity. And how I came up with these is thinking of models of disability. And I know that a lot of times the medical model of disability gets lumped in with pathological thinking in terms of binary right, wrong, this, if this is the problem, then this is the cure, right? Disease and cure kind of thing. But if you think of the medical model of disability being that the disability is linked to an individual's body and it requires accessing medical resources to attain a certain independence and quality of life, if you think of it that way, there are neurodivergents who fit under that medical model disability. They do need to access things for ambulation. They need caregiver support for hygiene, maybe like toileting and things like that, right? But all the neurodivergents really fit under a social model of disability that we know, where it's linked to the systemic barriers and societal discrimination, which is the whole point of the movement, right? And I think the fact that some neurodivergents do have those broader medical needs where they do need access to like high-tech AAC and ambulation devices and support and things like that, it feels like if you're only advocating through the social model of disability, it can feel very invalidating for those who are within the medical model as well, who do need access to all that stuff, because that stuff is expensive, you know? And at least in the United States, our medical system doesn't really like spending money on people, you know? Which that's just my little soapbox for that. That's my whole, regardless of what you think the medical system should be, I think one thing it shouldn't be is for profit. Because for-profit medicine is just the biggest conflict of interest ever. Like you set up, there's a system that has to spend money to keep people healthy and alive. And then you tell them to make a profit, which means they don't want to spend money to keep people healthy and alive, right? Like inherent conflict of interest there. So that's my little soapbox about that. For-profit medicine is pretty ridiculous and pretty absurd. It's like a complete contradiction. Anyways, off that soapbox. So the way I see it is some neurodivergents have these like comorbid conditions, right? Like motor impairments, like muscle coordination issues, or maybe hypotonia, like their posture support muscles, right? They can't really support themselves, or they're non-speaking, right? They have these issues that make their disabilities apparent to people. They have like a visual and or auditory tell that they have a disability, right? So I would call these people apparent neurodivergence. They have these disabilities that upon seeing them like in a park or in a grocery store, if you just see them out and about in public, there's a tell that they're disabled. Okay. Now there are those like myself who are more non-apparent. If you just see me walking around in a group, I might be talking to myself. So you might think I'm a little different, which does happen a lot. But on the whole, I don't have a lot of visual auditory tells that I'm neurodivergent, okay? I'm pretty non-apparent in that sense. And most late diagnosed autistics, late diagnosed ADHDers, we were likely pretty non-apparent as kids, or at least non-apparent enough that it wasn't a diagnosis available to us, okay? Which could mean that honestly, if you were assigned female at birth, you might not have been diagnosed, even if you were possibly more apparent, but it might not have been interpreted that way, of course, right? Barring that, of course, there's the discrimination issues. So here's how I see the breakdown, okay, with this. Non-apparent neurodivergence are not immediately perceived by others to be different, right? So a lot of our differences are in like cognitive differences, mental health, learning disabilities, things like that, right? And so therefore, a lot of us get assumed to be kind of, oh, you're just like one of us by like the overall group of people who are around. And we're given the option to mask, or oftentimes we learn to mask because once people spend enough time with us, they realize we're different. We're the weirdo, we're a little off, and they might not want to be our friends anymore, or we just might be a really good target for teasing. So then we learn to mask to have access to social interactions and to try to have more safe social interactions. Because I personally think masking is a form of a fawn response from that social rejection, which is pretty traumatic for most of us because it happens at a very young age where we don't really understand it and like, where's it coming from and why? And we do internalize that it's our fault. And then we want to learn to please people. We want to be like them so that we can have friends, right? So we learn to mask. That's for non-apparent neurodivergence. However, if you're a more apparent neurodivergent, like if you have really big sensory needs, that means you move your bodies in a way that's very obvious. If you have motor impairments, if you're just non-speaking, even if it's through, you know, a selective mutism or not, you have some sort of tell that you're different, right? When people see you or they first hear you, they know you're different. And that results in perceived differences, right? And you might need access to medical devices to assist with gaining independence, right? But the main thing is, because your difference is perceived, apparent neurodivergents are not given an option to mask, really. They're automatically treated differently. So there's no need for them to even learn how to mask because people automatically will keep their distance from them or be scared of them or maybe see them as an easy target for bullying or something, right? But they don't really need to learn how to mask because people automatically think something's wrong. And I think all of that comes together to result in different experiences when it comes to systemic barriers and also individual barriers to access for supports. So let's break that down a little bit. And like I said, I do have a visual on Instagram about this. So if you would like a visual, I do have slides. Maybe I'll put the link to that post in the show notes here. So apparent neurodivergence, if we think of a parent, so people whose it's obvious, you look at them and you go, yep, they have a disability. Like Stephen Hawking, by the time he was in a wheelchair, and then especially when he started using speech generating device. Apparent neurodivergence get really overtly stigmatized in society. These are the folks who maybe if you're out in public and a child is looking at them or staring at their mobility device, for example, and then the parent says, oh, don't stare or don't ask them about that. Oh, no. Right. Instant stigma gets kind of trained into children where it's like it's rude, you know. And then also apparent neurodivergence 9 times out of 10, it could also be non-apparents, but particularly apparent neurodivergence, they definitely have more enforced social isolation. Like historically, they were usually the ones placed in asylums at a really young age. And even in current day, they're still the ones, 9 times out of 10, they're the ones in the self-contained classroom. So they don't get as much access to their sort of general population peers, right? So apparent neurodivergents are also often denied access to the supports they need to achieve independence. So they're not presumed competent. So, oh, we're not going to use that high-tech AAC because I don't think they can use it, right? Or there's that spread effect. So even if they're seeing someone with like limb apraxia or something, they assume that also relates to the person's cognitive ability. And they might erroneously, you know, will get diagnosed with an intellectual disability and things like that and not given access to high-level education in that sense, right? And the other thing with apparent neurodivergence, and the thing especially that becomes a real issue when you think of individual access to the medical needs, is they have overtly, like obviously costly support needs, like explicitly costly, right? Mobility aids cost money. High-tech AAC costs money. 24/7 caregiver support costs a lot of money, especially when you're talking about adults who have that level of support. And also another part of that that I think should be included in the support needs and the cost, but often is not, is that there's little to no supports for parents and guardians of children who fall into this category. So like there is like truly, I honestly think it's like just grossly negligent of the medical community to not provide appropriate mental health support, appropriate amount of time off for caregivers so that the guardians can actually be enjoying their time with their child and not just constantly be tending to medical needs, right? We know there's a huge mental health cost with that. We know that results in a lot of issues when it comes to potential neglect and things like that, because it is just like, how can you forge a parent-child or guardian-child type relationship when you're worried about their tubes and their machine and their wheelchair breaking and you're on calls with the providers and this and that? And like, when do you have time to like just enjoy your kid, right? And I think it's incredibly negligent that our system doesn't even provide anywhere near the amount of time off that's needed for them to just be a parent for a while, right? Like, honestly, there should be time every day for them just to be there for their kid and just enjoy their kid, right? And the other thing I think that is incredibly unethical and negligent in our society, at least in the United States and likely in other countries in the world as well, is that we really don't have a good answer for what happens if something happens to their guardian. Like if the parent passes away, what happens to their child? Where do they go? Who takes care of them, right? We have some answers, but they're not often very ethical answers. They're not very good answers. We have institutions, we have skilled nursing, we have places like that they might go, but can we guarantee they won't face any level of medical neglect there? No, we cannot. Which is what I mean by we do not have a good answer. And I can only imagine the level of just genuine fear, right? How scary is that for a parent to know they can't guarantee their child's safety through life, you know? Like that is really hard, which also swings back to we need an answer to that. And then the parent also needs mental health support for that, because that is a really scary thought, which I can only imagine how impactful that is on and how dangerous that can be to someone's mental health. Okay. So when we think about non-apparent neurodivergence though, so let's break that down a little more. So non-apparent neurodivergence, like myself, the ones who are given an option to mask and often learn how to mask, we have this implicit societal stigma, right? It's kind of hidden, right? The ableism's kind of tucked into things. It's kind of sprinkled throughout and we can't always see it, right? But essentially we get all the social rejection and isolation that happens after we're initially welcomed into the classroom or to the peer group. It's after we get welcomed and treated like, oh, you'll be a fun friend to have. And then they start to see that maybe we're a little weird, a little off. And then we start to get the teasing and the bullying from our peers, but also quite frankly, authority figures and adults, teachers. Like we tend to be the ones who get called out a lot in class and used as examples of what not to do and how not to be. So we get it from all sides, right? We get assumed to be lazy or too sensitive or too crazy, right? We get these really negative messages that just get embedded in our brains about ourselves from a very, very young age, right? Non-apparent neurodivergents also tend to have our disability denied. Our needs, our accommodations frequently get denied. It's like, oh, you're just being lazy or you just want to get away with things, right? And then there's this really persistent shaming narrative that leads to that internalized ableism, right? We start to internalize this message of maybe we are just lazy. Maybe we aren't trying hard enough. Maybe we are trying to get away and we're kind of a cheater, right? And that is really, really damaging to mental health. We have so many studies now that show how incredibly damaging to mental health that is and how much of a connection that is to depression and anxiety and all of that stuff. And for some literature on that, you can look into the minority stress model would be a good place to look. I might be able to put some links in the show notes below. Now, the other thing about non-apparent neurodivergence is there are costs to being a non-apparent neurodivergent, like the ADHD tax, where ADHDers have to replace lost or forgotten items a lot. There's late fees to pay for bills. There's lost employment. There's changing jobs a lot due to some kind of implicit bias in the workplace where we're, you know, stigmatized and chastised and sort of do not feel welcome, essentially. So we either change the job on purpose or we actually get pushed out of our jobs a lot. And we don't really know, we don't have like a big report that says what the actual cost of that is to society at large, which would probably be really useful for somebody to come up with that. It would probably be a really useful statistic to promote actually providing accommodations for non-apparent neurodivergence in the workplace. But because it's so easy for people to deny our disability, and because, yes, usually we can accomplish things without the accommodations for a while, and then we're going to hit a burnout status or just a giant wall of we're out of mental effort, we're out of mental energy, we have no more spoons left to do this. But because we've done it before, it will get denied, right? Well, if you did it once, you could do it all the time, right? So we don't really have good data on how much that costs society that these late diagnosed autistic adults or late diagnosed ADHDers or just non-apparent neurodivergence in general, how much does it cost society that we have to change jobs and get training and all that stuff, right? How much does it cost in organizations? We don't really have data on that, but I bet there is a pretty hefty cost to that, right? One note on all of this is that I don't think apparent and non-apparent are concrete categories. These aren't the kind of categories where somebody is in one and they'll stay there their whole life. Some people might, but I think a lot of people will probably move and vary from non-apparent to apparent or vice versa due to like the kind of developmental stage you're in, maybe levels of regulation that's available to you, the environment someone is in, like in the case of what we know of as selective mutism, but I like to call it situational mutism because then we can keep the same acronym, you know what I mean? But yeah, environments change, the need for a communication device or not changes, right? The kind of sensory needs people might need for different environments, right? That can change you from apparent to non-apparent, or sorry, from non-apparent to apparent. And then also health status changes, right? I mean, anyone who works in rehab with adults who've had brain injuries of any kind, they become kind of apparent, right? They have an apparent disability, right? If someone has hemiparesis and they now need a wheelchair to get around in after a stroke, they are an apparent, they have an apparent disability, right? That they did not have before. So not concrete categories, right? Another good example of this for myself would be I'm non-apparent most of the time, but I usually can save my meltdowns for when I'm in private, but let's say one day I can't stop the meltdown and it happens in some sort of semi-public area, like I make it to a restroom and then I have a meltdown, right? If you're someone who only heard me or saw me in that bathroom, it would be pretty apparent to you that I'm pretty different, right? That person might think, whoa, that person definitely has issues, right? But in my day-to-day life, professionally speaking and such, and even just regular going about my life, I'm usually pretty non-apparent unless people actually interact with me and they realize how incredibly weird, and I say that in an affectionate way toward myself, I am, right? So, and the more I unmask, the more apparent I become, the faster it is to notice that I'm a little different, you know? I don't usually have people questioning my diagnosis once they've actually interacted with me for like 2 minutes. People don't usually question it. So I'm guessing it becomes fairly apparent once you hear me talk. Anyways, nonetheless. So going forward, when I talk about neurodivergent affirming care, and I like to use the word neurodivergent more so than focusing solely on autistics and autism, and I know that's the broader category, but I like to focus on neurodivergent as the main term because these same categories still apply to people with mental health disabilities, right? Schizophrenia versus depression and anxiety, right? In terms of more apparent versus non-apparent. There are neurodivergents out there that don't fit the same categories. And, you know, people with genetic syndromes and things too, right? Like we know there's plenty of neurodivergencies out there. There's plenty of things that result in a person not being able to access necessary accommodations and or medical assistance to attain a certain quality of life, right? So I like using neurodivergent as a term and talking neurodivergent affirming care. Sometimes I will mention autistics. Sometimes I will also say we, because I feel that I belong in ADHD and also a bit in autistic as well. I think I'm getting a little more comfortable with calling myself the ADHD, the AUDHD or type person. So a little more comfortable with that. But I think using things when we're talking about apparent and non-apparent neurodivergence and the types of adversities that are faced systemically due to bias, discrimination, lack of access, et cetera, lack of support financially, particularly from the medical system and insurance and such. I think using these type of categories will be a lot more helpful when we're talking about things in the context of the social movement toward equity and access and inclusion, right? And I just think it's time within that movement to focus a lot more on how society systems fail neurodivergence and not just in how neurodivergence are perceived by the system as failures. So flipping the script a little bit, focusing on the systemic adversities rather than the individual adversities and trying to lump all of it under the same category. Because we do have different adversities, but that doesn't mean that within the movement, we're not fighting toward equity and access together, right? So hopefully that helps to clarify. If you find these terms useful, if you like conceptualizing it this way, please do start using these terms if they are useful to you. If you have a better idea of how to talk about these things and talk about the different societal adversities, if you have better labels, better terminology, let me know. I will adopt it in a heartbeat. I do not think my terms are like the best, but I do think it's a place to start if we want to parse out systemic adversity from individual adversity in the context of the neurodiversity movement. All right. With all that said, next time I will be, gosh darn it, I will be, I'm going to hold myself accountable here. I couldn't say those two words together right then. I will talk about, I'll start the burnout series and talk about things that really impact mental health in a negative way in the context of burnout and also secondary traumatic stress, aka compassion fatigue, aka vicarious trauma, because especially as speech language pathologists, we sure are exposed to an awful lot of clients that have had trauma that we know about, right? So we'll get into that. I hope you guys have a great week or two, and do please join me again as we all discover what it means to be trauma-informed SLPs. Woohoo! Pew, pew, pew.